It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Yesterday, Pope Francis wrote his first official document as Pope. In that document, he called for big changes in the Roman Catholic Church, saying it needs to rethink some of its rules and customs.
And he was outspoken on issues of income inequality and very critical of what he called trickle-down economics.
Eileen Burke Sullivan joins us now. She's Associate Professor of Theology. She's the holder of the Barbara Reardon Heaney Chair in Theology at Creighton University in Nebraska. Eileen, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with how the Pope communicated this message. It was an apostolic exhortation. What exactly is that?
Well, an apostolic exhortation is one of several kinds of papal communications. Usually they're attached specifically to a meeting that the bishops have had with the Pope earlier. So there's a synod or a meeting of the bishops last year, and they discussed the new evangelization or the evangelization process, the work of proclaiming the gospel in culture. And so the papal apostolic exhortation is a kind of a summary and a reflection on and a kind of official gathering of teaching about the content of that meeting. It's a major teaching document.
And in this document, there were a lot of things, any one of which could have gotten headlines, and he put a lot of them in there. Let's start with the evangelizing thing. One thing I thought he said was interesting was we're kind of downers when we're evangelizing. I think there was a line something like, when you're evangelizing, when we're spreading the faith, we shouldn't look like we just came from a funeral.
Exactly. He's very strong about the fact that the medium, I mean, he doesn't say this way, but he's coming out of the medium is the message. If we are grumpy and doer and feeling defeated, we will never accomplish the gospel, which is full of joy.
And one of the big things, one of the big headline getters was challenging the Catholic Church's top-down hierarchy, and that's very significant coming from the person at the top of that hierarchy.
At the top of the top-down, yes, it is. Yes, he really has, and he has said this a number of times, even before this document came out. This is kind of a summary of some other things he said, but he has said in no uncertain terms that we need to return to a way of, or to a practice that is more collegial in terms of consultative and decision making, that is more regional and effectively takes into account local culture and local community.
This is a debate that's gone on, like a lot of things you talked about, for years, for centuries in the Catholic Church, isn't it?
Yes. Actually, structural debates particularly have been a big part of the tradition or part of the history of the life of the Church, which makes sense because, for one thing, it's an old community. It's a couple thousand years. And it's gone through all kinds of political contexts. You know, all sorts of social political contexts have surrounded the Church, from the Roman Empire all the way through the feudal system of the Middle Ages and the rise of nation states and then the development of democracy and so on. So if you follow sort of world history or cultures, development of cultures, you can see where the ecclesial community in many respects adopted kind of parallel types of structures.
But there's part of the argument against that is the idea that the Church and the hierarchy should be a conservative institution, not politically, but in that we maintain values despite what might be changing in a particular culture or the polls of the day or the fashions of the time. Is that a tension that's going to be hard to resolve for the Pope?
It's never resolvable. It's a consistent tension. And actually, if you look closely at Catholic teaching, it's always tensive. It's always a both and. There are two sides to sort of every kind of statement. And so you're going to see this throughout the document. Actually, as he talks, he'll say, you know, we have to go here, but we have to be aware that this is true, and so forth and so on. So you're going to find these tensions. And yes, there is a tremendous tension in reading the signs of the times, as the Constitution on the Church in the Modern World called it back at Vatican II in the 60s, how do we look at the modern world and be church within the culture and time that we are? And yet, how do we hold these transcendent teachings and values of Jesus?
And now he's calling for a more humble attitude as part of changing this leadership style, not just in practice changing it, but really changing an attitude, it sounds like. Is this something that you think was shaped from his fairly humble background and maybe being the first Latin American pope?
Oh, I think it's very definitively he reflects the fact that he comes out of a culture where a massive part of the population are poor, and the ministry of the church is very often with the poorest of the poor. And so there's a very powerful sense of the need to recognize that if we're going to reach every human person, you've got to somehow be to them in a way that they can hear and see and value. And if the church comes across as distant and know-it-all and pompous and separate or above, that is very off-putting to the human condition.
Again, this is not a new debate. A whole monastic orders were started over the issue of how flashy should the church be, how distant, right, how connected with the poor, and of course the Protestant splitting off from the church.
Absolutely. So in fact, historically, when the ecclesial community, when the Catholic ecclesial community has forgotten that its mission is to address the poorest and the humblest in many, many respects, I mean, Jesus himself came among the least politically powerful and among the poorest community in that least politically powerful body. So, I mean, he came into time in history not among the wealthy and the powerful, but among the people of the land. And that's the message that we have to keep iterating, because it is true that, as you know, we are in favor of the progress of peoples in a very positive way and the development of human enjoyment of this world or comfort in this world, but not at the expense of others.
And Pope Francis is saying these things. Is this something that had been a movement in the church recently with his predecessors, or is he really, with his humble tone, with this idea of getting away from the rigid hierarchy, is he really setting off a new path in recent history?
Well, it's not entirely new, no. I mean, it's a recurrent theme, as you pointed out, in the church's history, and probably most recently as the Second Vatican Council, within the 4 years that it met in the mid-60s of the last century, from 62 to 65, the church really, there was a huge impetus toward being a poor church for the poor. And that was even embedded in the constitution on the church in the modern world, that the church needs to really redress the poverty of the world and to be itself a witness to the poor, in the sense of material poverty is not itself a good, but material poverty helps us recognize that God's in charge and we're not. Sometimes when we have great material comfort or wealth, we think that material comfort or wealth makes us invulnerable. And the real message of simplicity of life, or even poverty, is that we are dependent. We're dependent, first of all, on God, and then we're dependent on brothers and sisters.
Well, following on the theme of poverty, one of the things that I think captured the most attention in this document from Pope Francis is his comment on capitalism, on trickle-down economics. He quotes a Catholic theologian, St. John, and I'm sorry I can't pronounce the last part, but here's the quote, "Not to share one's wealth with the poor is to steal from them and to take away their livelihood."
That's right. Exactly. And I think this document, he is about as sharp as he could possibly be. Now, interestingly enough, John Paul II, probably 25 or 30 years ago, said some very similar things. But it didn't have the kind of, what do I want to say, hearing that this has.
And not just Pope John Paul II. Other predecessors recently have talked about poverty. They've been critical of capitalism and material wealth. Why is Pope Francis, though, more outspoken? Is he laying it out there more strongly, maybe, than his immediate predecessors?
You know, I think if you think about his immediate predecessors, they come out of European culture and European middle class. Even John Paul II, while he was in a second world, you might say, country in Poland growing up, his family was not among the poorest of the poor. They were educated, they were middle class in a communist society, which wasn't wealthy by any stretch by our standards, but he didn't worry about where his food came from next the next day or that day. And Benedict came out of a scholarly family in Germany, and I don't think probably much of his life he ever had to worry much about where his next meal was coming from. Not that he wouldn't be aware, excuse me, of the world's poor and so on. But when you minister as Francis has done in barrios, huge communities in Latin America, where not only the next meal but the next anything for human beings is really questionable, and every person you're talking to is living on a life and death edge of poverty, and that if you have anything and don't share it or give it away, you somehow would know that you're depriving people. I mean, he has come out of a ministerial culture. I think his own family was reasonably comfortable. Middle class, you might say, in a culture that's largely poor and wealthy. He was of a smallish population of middle class, but he was thrust into a ministerial context as the bishop of as the auxiliary bishop of Buenos Aires, of one of the poorest sections of the city, and this is one of the poorest sections of one of the poorest cities in the world. So he was really dealing with people who are living on garbage heaps, and he could not but know that what this does to the human condition.
Eileen Burke Sullivan is with us. She's associate professor in the Department of Theology at Creighton University in Nebraska, talking about a document from Pope Francis raising a lot of issues around the world.
And we were curious about what you think about what the Pope had to say and the direction it seems to indicate that the Catholic Church might be moving in. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time.
We're talking to Eileen Burke Sullivan. She's associate professor of theology at Creighton University in Nebraska about the new document from Pope Francis, the Apostolic Exhortation, raising issues of income inequality, changing the church hierarchy, and a lot more.
And we'd like to know what you think about that. What do you think about the Pope reaching out, saying political topics, talking about income inequality, talking about trickle-down economics? Are you interested to hear a Pope talking about this? And what do you think it says about the direction the Catholic Church might be moving in? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org.
Which your calls in a couple minutes. But first, Eileen, how much of an influence do you think an announcement like this from Pope Francis has on the way Catholics think, approach the world here in the United States?
Well, what I would love to have people do is actually read the whole text. Now, it's relatively lengthy, so they may be more likely to read summaries of it and that sort of thing. But I think that it will cause serious Catholics to ask very serious questions about their own attitudes and values, about their own spending habits, about the way our parishes are organized, and the way whether we're outward concerned or just concerned about ourselves. I would think it would raise questions in my colleagues and fellow co-religionists' minds about health care, which is certainly a major topic today, about a number of other issues, political and social issues, that we face in the United States, and not the least of which, of course, is the care of the poor and the outcast. And the Pope makes no bones about the fact that he wants countries to be compassionate to migrants, to those who are not documented peoples, that are forced for economic reasons and otherwise out of their countries. He wants us to be very conscientious about the desperate need for health care, and particularly for the poorest and the weakest and so forth. So, I mean, there are many things that we could meditate on or chew on in the text. I don't know how easily people will hear it. I think people who agree with him will be thrilled, and people who are, you know, coming from another perspective will either be suspicious or at least challenged.
We'll go to our callers now. We have Adam with us in Manitowoc. Adam, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, great discussion. I'm not myself a Roman Catholic, but I've been following this particular issue and debate for many years, back to John Paul II's writings, including to the current Pope. My concern is that when popes like Francis make these sort of statements about caring for the poor, we automatically assume that they're talking about state-run welfare programs, when it seems to me that Francis and other popes have followed a long line of Catholic thought, such as from G.K. Chesterton, Hilaire Belloc, drawing a middle road between socialism and capitalism, and that being distributism. So I'd like to get your guest comments on that. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Adam. Eileen, what do you think?
Well, I think that your caller's correct in saying that that there's a temptation to immediately think of, you know, of political or social programs. On the other hand, we can't discount political and social programs if that's a way that people are generally taken care of. I think you have to deal with various cultures and the way they deal, you know, the way they respond. One of the things that Francis is going after is a social system that, in the character of the social system, whether it's an economic system or a political system, that there is a body of human beings who are disposable. And whether those are the poor, or whether those are women, or whether those are people of color, or whether those are undocumented peoples, or whoever the disposable group is, we systematically reject them through the social and political systems. And that's where political systems need to change. Now, I would say in this document, the Pope is very, very strong that persons and communities of faith and so on have to take personal and corporate responsibility for addressing world issues and local issues of poverty. So the local and the world, if you will.
We'll go now to Perry in Milwaukee. Perry, hi.
Good afternoon. My comment is, it seems to me, first of all, I'm an Orthodox Christian. Mm-hmm. And the two previous popes, to Pope Francis, were very adamant on trying to get the Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church back into unity. And it has appeared to me that a papacy of Francis was actually, the stage was actually set under Benedict XVI by doing things like rolling back limbo and some of those things, and even prior to his papacy, when he kind of kept John Paul II on the proper track, the proper Catholic track. And I personally, as an Orthodox Christian, would love to see this man, Pope Francis, as primus inter pares of the worldwide Christian Church.
Wow.
And I was just wondering what your guest thoughts are on Benedict XVI actually laying the groundwork for Francis and the direction he's taking the Catholic Church in now.
Perry, a lot there, but Eileen, Pope Francis as first among equals, not just head of the Catholic Church, but in some way reuniting the Catholic and Orthodox faiths?
Well, I will tell you that he has made tremendous efforts already in that direction and tremendous strides, and he's the first pope to have attracted several Orthodox patriarchs to his installation as pope in 1,000 years. So, and part of that's because he's built deep personal friendships with Orthodox leaders in various parts of the world through the years as Archbishop of Buenos Aires and so on. So there is a foundation in his own ministry. But you're right that Benedict and John Paul II saw, and actually John 23rd prior to that, really worked very, very hard to begin to lay the groundwork toward dialogue and relationship to reopen doors and to find ways of ameliorating some of the differences and divisions that have plagued us for 1,000 years between the East and the West.
Thanks for the call, Perry. We've got Matt in Tomo with us now. Matt, hi.
Hi, guys. It was interesting because the very first Christians were the poor people, and I believe what we've gotten away from is the fact that the church has neglected its responsibility. You know, we were the first ones to have the first hospitals and first orphanages and things like that, and we've kind of neglected our responsibility to be the church, and we just said to the government, you guys do it for us. And I think what Francis maybe getting at, like you indicated earlier, Eileen, is that we want to take some of this responsibility back, the spirit of generosity and, giving an immigrant worker like myself. What I did is I told a guy whose van broke down. I'm like, I'm just doing little things like that to help out. And so we just need more of that kind of spirit. So.
All right. Matt, thanks for the call. Eileen, is he capturing a lot of the intent, do you think, of Pope Francis?
I think there's both in there. I mean, I think that we really have to hear the personal responsibility that Francis calls everyone to care for his or her brothers and sisters that are surrounding you. So the poor in your community are your responsibility to some extent. Now, do we mediate that only through private charity, or do we mediate that through a systemic consciousness of holding up and caring for the poor publicly? In the United States, we've kind of struggled with both. We've found ways to grant tax deductions for those who give charity, but we also have tried to develop some social programs when the problem is too great for personal or private charity to cover. So I think we have to be open to the fact that there's not a single answer, but what there is a profound personal and corporate responsibility.
Eileen, thank you so much for joining us today.
You are very welcome.
That's Eileen Burke Sullivan. She's an associate professor of theology at Creighton University in Nebraska.
Our guest says it's time to rewrite the United States Constitution. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Coming up, an event on Monday brings high school students from around Wisconsin together with a Nobel Prize-winning novelist. We'll talk about the effort to bring world literature to state schools. But first, we're having trouble reaching our guest on the idea of rewriting the U.S. Constitution. We'll keep trying and hopefully bring you that discussion as planned. In the meantime, we're going to go to you for a little help. Earlier, we talked to author Sherman Alexie about independent bookstores and reading. He wrapped up with a book recommendation, and now we want some of yours. We're looking for your ideas on a great book to give as a holiday present. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. 800-642-1234. What book maybe is on your shopping list to give someone, or maybe one you'd like to receive, or something you loved reading and you think would make a great gift for someone? Again, the number, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Maybe our producer can get an item up on there for that.
Sherman Alexie's idea was that authors hand sell books in independent bookstores. Now we're asking you to, you know, quote unquote, hand sell a book to us. What book is one that you especially love and you think the message, the story, the whole experience of reading that book is one that you want to give as a gift to someone else? Something that you think stands the test of time, that has moved you, that you think a book with a legacy that's really meant something. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234.
So I'm thinking about books over the years that I've given people or loaned repeatedly, or I've heard of other people loaning. Some of the classics, I think you can never go wrong with a copy of The Princess Bride. Have you read that one, Veronica? I've seen the movie. I read the book
right,
as a kid.
I've seen the movie many times, but I guess I haven't read the book. That's an interesting idea.
Yeah, it's a wonderful book, and the story, it's like the movie in that there's the frame of the grandpa reading the story to his kid, but the book itself was supposed to be this really convoluted. The book he's reading to the kid was really convoluted, and he did the good parts version, just the exciting bits that made it into the action moments on the movie.
And I guess one of my favorites, one that I feel is one of the pinnacles of reading experiences of my life, has been Madeleine L'Engle and her Wrinkle in Time series. I just remember so much about reading that, and I'd love to pass that on to my kids and to other people as well. She's passed on, but she, I think, is an amazing writer, and those books stand up.
You know, the sad thing about that book for me is that's one my parents were recommending at a stubborn stage in my childhood.
So have you not read them?
I haven't read A Wrinkle in Time. My wife loved it, and okay, she recommends that for our kids. But no, I had this finicky stage. Some of the books I ignored at that point, I went back and read at some point. Some, like A Wrinkle in Time, I haven't.
All right, next time this month, you will have read them, right?
I've got a big stack of books, but okay. All right, no, I really should.
You really should. All right, well, let's see what Lars has to say. Lars is joining us in Stoughton. Hi, Lars.
Hi, good afternoon.
How you doing?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
What do you think? What is your vote?
My book that I'd like to recommend is actually called One Shot at Forever. It's a baseball story about the Macon High School baseball team out of Macon, Illinois. It's a kind of an underdog story where you root for the small team, and it took place back in 1970 or 71, and it's a true story, and it's a marvelous story about a small high school team that went out and played the state championships. So I guess I'll leave it to the reader after that.
Okay, that sounds like a good one. One Shot at Forever. Recommendation there from Lars, especially for baseball fans, and that's not one that I've heard of.
No, me neither. And for fans of good underdog stories, that's always a fun one to read. We want to hear your recommendations at 800-642-1234. A great book to give as a holiday gift. Fred is with us now in Madison. Fred, hi.
Hi there.
What's your recommendation?
I'd like to recommend The Westing Game. It's a puzzle mystery adventure set in Wisconsin on the Lake Michigan shore.
A puzzle and mystery. Explain, please. What do you mean that it's a puzzle?
A rich entrepreneur dies and leaves in his will a puzzle that his 16 heirs need to solve in order to get his estate.
Ah, okay. And it's set in Wisconsin, at least in part. And do you know the author's name off the top of your head, Fred?
I think it's Ellen Rastings.
Rastings, okay. And the title is The Westing Game. Thank you so much for the suggestion. That sounds like a fun one. And I always love things set in familiar places, too.
Yeah, that's great. These are two that I've never heard of. And this is the whole point of hand-selling books, like Sherman Alexie was talking about. That you get things you would never have heard of before. So thank you for that. And let's go next to Eric in Rochester. Hi, Eric.
Hello.
What do you think for a recommendation?
Well, I like the third version of Stephen King's The Stand.
The third version. So there are three of them?
Right. Right. There's the movie version. There's the original version he wrote. And then after he got famous, he had a third one where a bunch of characters and stuff, situations got cut out and put it all back in.
Oh, so it's kind of like getting the director's cut or something like that.
Yeah. And, you know, it just adds body and more. It's just a better read. And, you know, one of the things Stephen King's always said is, you know, because there's the whole movie versus book thing. He said, if you read the book first, you can use your imagination as to what these characters look like. On the other hand, if you see the movie first, like, you know, the Stand was a miniseries. I will always now equate one of the characters with Dauber from The Coach.
Yep, that's what happens when you see the movies.
Yep.
All right, well, Eric, thank you for that recommendation. The third version of The Stand has got all the extra material.
And I love that, you know, first Stephen King, who nobody had heard of, the editor probably could make all the cuts they wanted. Later on, I'm Stephen King. What I write is going to be in the book. The editor, put your stamp of approval on it and print that sucker.
You will not cut a single word of my book. Yes, excellent. Well, thanks a lot for that, Eric. And let's go next to Brad in Avoca. Hi, Brad.
Hi, I would like to suggest That Tree as a light read. It's actually by Mark Hirsch, and it's just coming out. It's a photo journal in the life of an oak tree over the year, one picture a day for a year.
Ooh, that sounds beautiful.
Yeah, I think he's been interviewed on several media outlets, including possibly WPR. I haven't even got it yet, but I've ordered it for all my Christmas presents. You can follow it on thattree.net. Just glorious pictures of a very old bur oak tree, and I think it'd make a very good gift and just kind of a light coffee table read.
Do you know where the tree lives? What state?
It's around Platteville, Wisconsin.
Oh, it is. Oh. Okay, another Wisconsin connection there. Mm. Yeah.
We should check and see if that author has, in fact, been on the WPR show, because if not, .. Yeah, we might want to check that out.
Excellent.
Exactly.
Yeah, I have a soft spot for anything with trees in it. And oak trees in particular. There's something so stately and majestic about oak trees. I'd love to see that photographic history. So thank you for that suggestion, Brad. That's something that you could page through and, you know, be uplifted by the sight of a tree. Thanks to Brad for that. And to Matt we go. Matt in Beloit. Hi, Matt.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing okay. How are you?
Great. I would like to recommend The Music Lesson by Victor Wooten, who is a Grammy Award-winning musician, and I would really recommend this book more for somebody who's a musician or somebody who's maybe new to music and is really looking for some inspiration. It's kind of a magical story. A character shows up at his house one day unexpectedly and winds up correlating a lot of musical life lessons into just everyday life in a really beautiful way.
Well,
really inspirational to me as a musician.
All right, Veronica and I are also music types. Do you think, is it approachable for non-musicians too?
It is. There are some little bits and pieces where they do go just mildly into music theory. I guess it might have some that might help if you're more into music. I don't really think it goes over anybody's head who doesn't know much about music, but there might be some parts where there's just a little bit of misunderstanding.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, Matt, I've got one for you if you're into music. Have you read Bel Canto?
No, I'm sorry. Can you say that again?
It's called Bel Canto. It's an older book. It's by Ann Patchett. I actually mentioned her earlier in the show. And it's...
Okay, yeah, I think that's why it sounds familiar.
Yeah, and it's about an opera singer in a South American country who gets held hostage at a dinner party. And it's one of the most lovely, lyrical books about music and a whole bunch of other stuff that I've read, if you like books about music.
Yes, appreciate it.
All right, thanks a lot for calling, Matt.
We are talking about holiday gift book suggestions, kind of a last-minute thing. A guest we've had trouble reaching. Who booked this one? Oh, it was me. Whoops. But you are helping us out by offering great books to get for someone or maybe that you'd love to get for the holidays. You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Actually, for music lovers, Patrick Rothfuss, who shows up on this show often, he's got his fantasy, two parts of his fantasy trilogy, starts with the Name of the Wind. And
The Wise Man's Fear is the second one.
And the main character, among other things, is a musician. And the performance scenes, I thought, were so dead on as somebody who's played in tiny little bars over the years that I thought Patrick Rothfuss must be a musician
himself.
That's
what you said to me. You said, I assume he's a musician.
And he corrected us on that. Yeah, he just writes compelling music scenes. But I think as a musician, our last caller might appreciate that as well.
Right. There's a whole lot of other stuff in there.
Right. It's not just music.
A whole fantasy saga. But yeah, there's some great scenes about being a musician there. And what about you? Would you like to call and hand sell us a book? Tell us about one you think would make a wonderful gift right now for the holiday season at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us what book you'd recommend.
More of your suggestions coming up. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're talking to you right now about books that you would recommend as a gift for this holiday season, an experience that was especially memorable that you loved reading and that you want to share with someone else as a gift. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post your thoughts and your recommendations on the Central Time Facebook page. And we go to Sarah, who's joining us from Wausau now. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
What do you recommend?
Thank you so much for the topic. I love it. I'm an English teacher, and I've taught middle and high school. My recommendation is actually a Sherman Alexie book.
Uh-huh.
It's called The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian.
Yeah.
And the reason that I love it is because it is great for young adult fiction. It's in that category, so it's good for teens and young adults. But it also has really deep themes of family dysfunction and bullying and race and just fitting in with friends and all of these things that really transcend age. And so it's a really good read.
Excellent. Yeah, that is one that I have loaned to people and you know, who are not young adults anymore. And it does, you're right. It absolutely is a read for anybody. Thank you so much for calling up and recommending that one.
Thank you.
All right, we'll go back to the phones now. We've got Aleda in Madison now. Aleda, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What's your recommendation?
My recommendation is Love Changes by Sherry Lucille, who is a local author.
Love Changes. And what was the author's name again?
Sherry Lucille.
Sherry Lucille. And what kind of book? What do you like about it?
Well, it's a love story, and I usually read self-help books. But this story really captivated me. It's set in the 1950s, which I'm a history buff anyway. And the kind of twist on it is it is an interracial love story set in the 50s, which brings up all kind of the racial tension issues and all that. And it's just a really well-written story, and it's really captivating.
All right. Thanks for the recommendation, Aleda. Love Changes.
Love Changes. All right. Thanks for that one. And on to Barbara, who's joining us in Oshkosh. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. What a great program.
Thank you.
About some really good books here.
Great. Well, what do you have for us?
Well, mine is a book I would recommend, not for everybody, but I recommend it to all women. And it's called The Secret Garden.
Yeah.
And it's like, have you read it?
I have a long time ago. It might be worth a reread. What do you love about it?
Well, what I loved about it, so I can't reveal, the problem is it's hard to talk about it without revealing the secret, is the daughters completely don't understand their mother, and they don't know why she acts the way she does. And so the whole book is this slow, beautiful revealing of the mother and her background and why she is the way she is and how it affects everybody's relationship in the family. And how we judge people sometimes incorrectly.
So Barbara, you said you only recommend it to women mostly. Could a guy like it? Is it possible?
I don't know, because it's all the main characters are all women, and the father is in the story, but I'm not sure if men would like it because it's so into women's and daughters, mothers and daughters relationship, but I'm not sure if a man would like it.
All right. Well, you know what, Barbara? I think that we should add it to Rob's reading list.
Well, it sounds like a challenge.
I think it's for younger readers, so you could breeze through it quickly.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a beautiful one, Barbara. Thank you so much. Did you say you had another one, or was that it?
No, I was just going to say that one other very cool thing about the book is up until the very last word of the book, we don't know the whole story. So it's still revealing.
Yeah, I've forgotten a lot about it. I bet that would bear another reading. Barbara, thanks so much for reminding us about The Secret Garden.
We've got an email from Paul. Our email, by the way, talk@WPR.org. Paul emails, many remember Carl Sagan for his public outreach, including the TV show Cosmos. He also wrote a present near-future science fiction novel, Contact. He says it does an outstanding, enduring job of laying out the depth and overlap of scientific, philosophical, and religious thought. And I think they made a movie out of that, didn't they?
Jodie Foster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much for the suggestion, Paul. Appreciate it.
Okay. Let's go next to Emily in Cable. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
What do you recommend?
I'd like to recommend another local Wisconsin author. David Rhodes is his name. And his most recent book is Jewelweed, which I think was read on Captor a Day. And in that same series, there's also Driftless and Rock Island Line. And they're all fantastic novels that just weave this intricate story of small town life with really interesting characters.
Oh, beautiful. You know, I've seen that book around, but I haven't read that one yet. I bet that is one, especially in Wisconsin, if you wanted to give a little slice of Wisconsin to someone. We've had lots of opportunities to do that with book recommendations today. And Jewelweed by David Rhodes is another.
All right. Thank you so much for that one. We've got Carl in Oshkosh with us now. Carl, hi.
Hi. I'd like to recommend, it's a 15 novel series about Horatio Hornblower, how he starts his life as a midshipman in the 1700s, and it chronicles his life through being a lieutenant, how to live on a ship, all the way through captaincy. And I think it's C.S. Forrester. I'm not sure on the author.
Okay.
But it's just a great book.
And it's a novel, right? Not nonfiction?
It's a fiction. Yeah, it's fiction. And it's a 15 book series.
Whoa.
I think there was a movie back in the 60s with Gregory Peck called Horatio Hornblower, which was one novel out of the 15.
Well, here's a thought. You could give somebody volume one this year, volume two next year, and you've got your gift buying for that person tied up for a long time, a decade and a half. No thinking, man.
Got it covered.
All right. Well, thank you so much. The Horatio Hornblower 15-volume set.
And let's go next to Sue. Sue is with us from Evansville. Hi, Sue.
Hi. I'd like to recommend a book called The Shadow of the Wind, and it's a book about book lovers.
Ah.
The a family in Barcelona, early 1900s maybe, and his father owns a bookstore, and he takes him to a place called the Cemetery of Forgotten Books. And he's allowed to pick out one book, and by choosing that book, it sets off a whole chain of events and mysteries that take place over the next decade.
Oh, that sounds great. I love that already. The Cemetery of Forgotten Books. That's perfect.
And the name of the book is The Shadow of the Wind.
The Shadow of the Wind. Did you say who the author was?
You know, I don't remember. It's been translated in English. I believe the author is, it's in my suitcase in the back of the car here, but I'm not stopping to find it.
That's all right. We'll take your word for it.
Carlos, something Spanish.
Shadow of the Wind, though. I think we can find it with that. A great suggestion. Mm-hmm. Thank you. We'll go to Michael with us in Wausau now. Michael, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What's your suggestion?
My suggestion is a Sand County Almanac written by Aldo Leopold. A lot of people may have heard of him. But this book would probably be for high school kids or older kids or adults. This was a series of essays that he did about conservation in Wisconsin. He's a Wisconsin author. There's also the Aldo Foundation. And I was so impressed by it when I read it a few years ago, I sent a copy to each of my four children.
So this is what you have given as a gift?
Correct.
All right.
And how did they like it?
As far as I know, they really appreciated it. And one of our grandchildren is in college, and he's interested in biology and conservation and so forth.
Oh, yeah.
So it's carried over, I guess.
That would be perfect. And I love this idea of reading locally and getting a deeper sense of the place where we live here in Wisconsin. There's a huge Wisconsin reading list here that we're uncovering alongside lots of others, but it's a chance to reacquaint yourself with parts of Wisconsin that you might not have known. So thank you so much for that, Michael. Appreciate it.
We'll go now to Bob in Spooner. Bob, hi.
Hi. Say, Veronica, you might like The Man Who Planted Trees. I believe it's by Jean Gigot. It's about a French war veteran who meets a peasant who's taken it upon himself to reforest a desolate and sparsely populated part of France. The Man Who Planted Trees. It was also a very beautiful short animated film a few years back.
So is this a novel?
I'd say it's more in the terms of a short story.
Okay.
I don't even think it's novella length. It's a very slight little volume.
Yeah, that's
beautifully illustrated as well.
That sounds beautiful. Thank you so much. And I've got one for you. You like trees. This is one you probably have to check out because it's probably huge and expensive, but it is beautiful. Thomas Pakenham, and I can't remember the name of it, but he photographs the most outstanding trees of the world in these giant colored photographs. I remember there are baobab trees and just iconic trees from all over the world. So that's another one with pictures. I love that yours is a story. Thank you so much, Bob.
You bet. Bye-bye.
And thanks to all of you for your great suggestions. If you still have one, share it with us on the Central Time Facebook page. That's Central Time on WPR. Or tweet us. On Twitter, we are Central Time WPR.
And coming up, a look at water conservation efforts at a Wisconsin cranberry producer and a chance for Wisconsin high schoolers to mingle with the Nobel Prize-winning novelist. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.